honestly, if you'd asked me 2 years ago, 100 gigawatts of new storage by 2030, I would have been like, yeah, that's pretty aspirational. I wouldn't say that's aspirational anymore. I would say, yeah, that's doable, actually.
Good day, everyone, and welcome back to Cutting Carbon. I'm your host, Jeff Goldmeer, and joined, as always, by my co-host, Brian Gutnick. Brian, good day.
Hey, Jeff, good day.
So I'm very excited. So today, our conversation is going to take a bit of a different route. We've talked a lot about production technologies. Today, we're going to talk about something a little different. Today, we're going to talk about energy storage. And for our conversation, we're joined by Jason Berwin, who's the current CEO of the Energy Storage Association. Jason, good day and welcome to Cutting Carbon.
Hey, thanks for having me, Jeff. Glad to be here.
So I thought we'd start with just a very simple question for our audience who may not have thought or heard about energy storage before. Can we just start with the basics? What is energy storage? What does it do?
Sure. So energy storage refers to a diversity of technologies that all have a singular goal, which is to take an input of energy, usually but not only in the form of electricity, store that energy by some means, that can be electrochemical, mechanical, thermal, and then redeliver it on demand. And so that is something that most folks are familiar with through batteries and battery technologies, also known as electrochemical technologies. But this is a technology class that has been around for a little bit, mostly in the form of pumped hydropower, where you pump water uphill with electricity and then hold it up above a dam before running it back through that dam later on. And we can get into the various technologies, but they all share that characteristic. And the reason why these are all called energy storage is to differentiate them from fuels. In general, we think of energy storage as a way in which you mostly take electricity or thermal inputs and are able to hold on to that energy for exactly when and often where it is going to be most useful to have.
So Jason, today on the grid, the vast majority of the energy that's produced is produced and consumed almost instantaneously. So what is it about energy storage that makes it such an important innovation for the grid?
Yeah, no, I think you touched on it there, Brian, that electricity has to be consumed the moment it's produced. You can't hold on to it effectively. And traditionally, we haven't had a way that's widespread and available and cost effective to do this. But when you have that capability, it opens up an enormous amount of new operational possibilities on an electric system that is otherwise designed for that physics constraint, right? Where you have to match supply and demand moment to moment, hour to hour, day to day, season to season, year to year. When you can relax that constraint of matching supply and demand precisely at all moments, that allows you to do things like, for example, use your existing power plants or wires infrastructure more efficiently. You don't have to build as much to match every moment of demand because you have this sort of store of backup that you can rely on. It allows you to be more resilient and reliable in your system because, whether through finding moment-to-moment stability on your grid or particularly at places like a household or a business, having just home backup, you're able to ride through more disruptive events, and you can adapt your supply mix more readily, regardless of what supply mix that is. The energy storage is going to help make non-dispatchable resources like wind and solar more dispatchable. It's going to help inflexible resources like nuclear and some coal be more flexible. It's going to help even flexible assets like gas generation have to cycle less frequently and can burn at more efficient heat rates. All of those capabilities are what energy storage unlocks on your system because you don't have to be completely constrained to that moment-to-moment, day-to-day matching of supply and demand all the time. And that means savings, right, by not having to spend as much money on your infrastructure or your capacity on the system. And of course, for those who are focused on clean energy in particular, given the amount of zero carbon resources that are expected to come from wind and from solar and from hydro, the storage provides a helpful complement to those non-dispatchable assets.
So Jason, great answer. I love how we think about this as a system. And one of our VPs, our chief technology officer, loves to talk about systems of systems. But as we think about energy storage, there are different types. Are there certain types of energy storage? You mentioned pumped hydro as an example. What are the types, and do those different types have certain advantages? Would you want to use pumped hydro in a certain circumstance and a battery in a different circumstance?
Absolutely. You know, the diversity of technologies is important in part because there's a diversity of applications, right? And the way to think about this is, what is the application or service that you're trying to provide, and where are you trying to do so? And those two distinctions make not all of the questions that you would answer, but a large set of them when you're thinking about technology choice. So the application space, oftentimes the way we think about this is for the duration of your energy storage that you need. If you only need to do like moment-to-moment grid stability, you may not need a very long duration asset, you know, an hour or less. And so batteries, of course, are the most commonly used, but for shorter durations, there are technologies that have been employed, like, say, flywheels, for example. We know that there are folks who are working with thermal storage technologies to help them kind of, in a sort of demand response manner, also provide that kind of grid stabilizing application. Then you move to sort of, you know, what I would call your conventional set of energy supply, where you're providing energy throughout the day. Maybe you're also providing some amount of reserves, and that can be sort of medium durations. Capacity, or sort of resource adequacy, that is to say, effectively what keeps your system reliable, that will vary based on the durations that you need in order to provide that system reliability. Will vary based on the type of system you're in and how the supply mix evolves over time. But these days, sort of a common standard that many folks are installing is sort of like 4-hour durations. And again, batteries are predominantly doing that, but of course you have other technologies also now supplying that, like pumped hydroelectric power, as was discussed. The space where I think there's a lot of innovation is what's generally referred to as long duration storage, where you're getting beyond sort of this diurnal intraday storage, but going to interday. So talking about 24 plus hours and sometimes up to weeks or months. And that is a space where you have all sorts of different technologies, different kinds of battery chemistries, not lithium ion, but others that might be sulfur based, for example, different forms of mechanical energy storage. So we know there are folks who are working in, for example, not just compressed air, but liquid air, cooling the air down so that it, in a similar fashion, you're using temperature rather than pressure to make it small and then re-expanding it to drive turbines. You've got underground or geomechanical pumped storage, which instead of an above-ground reservoir, it's a below-ground reservoir that could potentially be significantly larger. You've got thermal storage technologies, like using molten salts or molten metals in order to be able to run steam turbines for days and days and days. And of course, folks who are working into places like power to gas, this sort of long, long duration that you can get out of, it's conventionally being provided by fuels, but using an electricity input to create, for example, something like hydrogen that can then be run through a fuel cell or, for that matter, in a turbine. These are all sort of, again, technologies that are focused on meeting this longer duration. And I'll just note that that application space is getting busy precisely because folks are looking ahead and saying, what is the gap that we really need to meet? Current lithium-ion batteries are more than capable of dealing with the intraday needs of the grid. But for those days, weeks, or seasons, particularly if you expect the electric system to have a much higher share of wind and solar power, that's where a lot of the attention is going. The last thing I'll just say is in terms of location, I know I spent most of my time here on applications, but in terms of location, that also matters. Pumped hydro and some of these larger technologies that have to be fairly large in order for the economics to work out, are really only going to be installed at transmission voltages on the bulk power system, maybe down to distribution voltages at some point, but these are large facilities and installations. And so they're going to provide bulk system services. Other technologies, though, batteries, of course, being the common one today, are able to be installed in homes or in businesses. You know, they can be sited at customer premises, what is traditionally called behind the meter. So when you think about utilities, power system, there's all the things that are in front of the customer meter. That's the utilities, grid infrastructure, and generation assets. And then there's the customer's premises, which their electrical panel and all their different appliances, that's behind the meter. And so providing storage in those locations gives you the ability to provide not just the end user value through things like backup power, but also, as we're seeing more and more, the ability to turn those assets outward to also support the larger grid. And that's where a lot of the innovation in this space is. So that's why when you're thinking about technology choices, it's primarily application, but also location.
And just to clarify for our listeners, right, when we talk about a behind the meter, whether US or Europe, you're talking about either a 110, 120, or like a 210, 220 kind of voltage. But Jason, when you talk about bulk energy storage on the distribution system, that's what we're talking about, 100,000 volts, kind of, you know, very high voltage for these bulk systems, I'm assuming.
Yeah, no, I pardon my jargon. Indeed, high voltage, you know, the big wires that you see strung across the landscape on those massive towers, that's transmission voltages. Things that connect to that tend to be pretty big versus the wires in your home or on the street in front of your house.
Great. You're listening to Cutting Carbon. I'm your host, Jeff Goldmere. If you have a question on today's episode, a question on decarbonization in general, or a suggestion for a future episode of this podcast, drop me a note. You can reach me at cutting.carbon@ge.com.
Hey, Jason, the fastest growing segment within kind of energy storage seems to be the lithium ion battery. And I assume largely driven by the scale that electric vehicles are kind of bringing the cost down on that technology, where it's becoming economical, as you say, for the hourly, hour to hour, within a day shifting of energy. How would you assess the longer duration, let's say greater than 8 hour duration storage technologies in terms of their cost effectiveness today? And where do you see them headed, you know, over the future?
Sure. I mean, first of all, I love all of my children, so I'm not going to tell you which ones are better than which. But I will say that the reason why there is so much innovation in this space is because there's such a big prize to be had here. The National Renewable Energy Laboratory has released this report recently called sort of the four stages of energy storage, where they're kind of tracking the technology evolution they see predicated on what's expected to be a low or zero carbon power system. And you look at the shorter durations, that's like 20, 30 gigawatts. You look at what we've called intraday or diurnal storage. That's, NREL guesses, maybe up to 100 gigawatts. But when you look at the longer duration, you're getting into the multiple hundreds of gigawatts. And that's further out in time, of course, but that's why there's so much focus on this. And I think the key thing to understand is that you're going to have different project economics based on different technologies. So some of these technologies are very sort of installation driven. Pumped hydro is a perfect example. That's more of a civil works than it is a product. That's a really, truly massive thing in general. And it's hard to say that you have the economics like a product. It's hard to say that any one trajectory is what these technologies follow. Versus what I think folks are used to with batteries, which is highly commoditized, unitized product that you can actually follow a cost trajectory precisely because it is a commodity, right? And so that's a way to sort of differentiate how to think about how these evolve over time and why some of the plays look the way they do. So things like pumped hydro, certain kinds of mechanical storage, like compressed air, potentially, or liquid air. A lot of those plays are based around you get economies of scale and really potentially competitive costs by having very large projects over time. And some amount of not just the learning by doing, but if you can get your system setups to become more turnkey, for example, right? Then there are some that are more materials driven. So like part of the reason why I think folks are drawn to thermal storage like molten salts or molten metals is because then it's really a materials question. So it's less about, I mean, it's obviously there's a certain degree to which it's an installation, but the storage medium device, that can be somewhat unit driven because it's like how much material is used, right? And so the more material gets used, perhaps there's, again, a scale effect through the production of it. And then there's a sense to which how modular are these things, right? So capital intensity is one route to good project economics, but another route may be to get to very capital light projects that can be replicated quickly. And that's sort of the lesson I think a lot of folks have taken from current lithium ion batteries, right? Is that, you know, those capital costs can come down very fast if you've got something that's highly modular and replicable. So that's where I think you're seeing some electrochemistries that are not lithium ion, whether that's certain types of sulfur-based batteries, potentially other kinds of flow batteries. And then, you know, again, that materials basis, that's where a lot of the power to gas comes from. It's a volume production basis at some point. And, you know, you have capital costs associated with things like electrolyzers that need to come down. But fundamentally, these are different pathways towards the same goal of pushing a cost curve down by different kinds of expected deployment trajectories. So I can't give you a prognostication on what's going to be at what cost level. It's more like understanding how do these costs change over time, and therefore understanding what we are likely to see with different technologies. The last thing I'll note is that you had mentioned originally that the reason why we are talking about lithium-ion batteries in the grid today is indeed the cost declines more driven by the vehicles market and the global build-out of supply for vehicles. Vehicles are batteries on wheels for more and more folks. And there's also a separate thing happening afoot here, which is important to keep an eye on. You have minimum 10x the amount of battery storage being deployed in vehicles than is being deployed in the grid. And those vehicles are spending potentially 90%+ of the time stationary. Many of them could be plugged in. And so I think there's obviously been a lot of interest generated since Ford's announcement of their electric F-150, and obviously Tesla before them, on the potential for this massive latent fleet of mobile batteries to have a function on the grid. And I don't think we've seen as much analysis of what that can do, but I think it's important for folks to bear in mind, just given the staggering scale that we expect to see floating around there on wheels, right?
Hey, Jason, I want to pause this for a moment. You've used a couple of technologies that I'm not sure all of our audience is familiar with. And maybe if you can just give a brief description of a couple of these. We mentioned flow batteries.
Yeah. So a flow battery, it's the same principles as the current batteries you're used to, like a lithium ion battery. The difference is that the electrodes, that is to say the two different materials that exchange electrons backwards and forwards, which is how you get an electric current out of a battery. In conventional batteries, those are metals or solid materials. A flow battery, those are liquids. So what happens is that instead of having, say, two chunks of metal separated by a membrane with electrolyte, which is how a conventional battery works, you have two giant tanks of liquid electrodes called catholyte and anolyte instead of cathode and anode. And they are run through pipes and across a membrane against each other. So you have no electrolyte because you're already using liquid electrodes. And across that membrane, they do the same kind of passage of protons that allows you to get your electrons out of them and run a current. And so the reason why folks are interested in flow batteries is because they solve a certain scalability issue with batteries, which is that you want longer duration or more power, you just make your tanks bigger. How much liquid electrode you store is really becomes the limit. Whereas for batteries, battery arrays, you have to array them into modules and racks and containers and then build more of those. And so it's a slightly different strategy for scaling and installation in the flow battery, but also why folks in the flow battery space are looking towards longer durations, right? Because they see that as a potential play as you increase the tank sizes.
Great. You'd also mentioned a molten metal storage. I'm assuming that's a scenario where you're storing energy by basically melting a metal back into a liquid, and then later you extract that energy by allowing the metal to resolidify.
Exactly. So for a lot of these advanced thermal storage media, that's precisely it, right? Is you're using the heat, or I mean, I should note, there are folks working on Coolth as well, primarily heat-driven, and that input energy is certainly can be electricity, right? Like an aluminum smelter is a perfect example. But you could also have a direct input of heat energy, which is what the sort of principle of concentrating solar power has been and where molten salt was first used for a storage medium. But that's also something we're now seeing being integrated into thermal power plants. So, for example, there is now, I think, a recently announced project in Wyoming to build a nuclear power facility that dumps excess heat into a molten salt medium. And the reason they want to do that is because nuclear has traditionally been inflexible. But when you add that molten salt medium that is taking a lot of excess heat, you create a part of the facility that can then cycle the output up and down without you having to do anything with the reactor core, which is much safer and more flexible. So that's the real benefit of a thermal storage solution, is that you have that capability. And again, you can scale it by the size of the containment vessel and the amount of material in it and that material's thermal mass.
And there are a couple other storage technologies, I think, and you talked about pumped hydro being a civil works, as we talk about having two bodies of water separated by some elevated distance, so we take advantage of the potential energy difference. But as we think about projects where the construction of the project, the moving earth, if you will, whether it's a pumped hydro, I think there are others that would fall into that category. We've talked about compressed air energy storage. You probably need a cavern to do that. If we're talking about hydrogen storage, are folks looking at storing hydrogen in caverns underground? So I guess there's probably a whole category of storage technologies for which the earthworks, if you will, are pretty massive, right? That's going to be a driver for the ability to do some of those storage, whether they're medium or longer term storage.
Absolutely. And I think that it's important to bear that in mind, right, is that, you know, we have an enormous industrial organization capability here in the United States focused on subterranean everything. The U.S. has the most advanced oil and gas sector in the world, and we should be looking at that as an enormous benefit for these kinds of energy storage opportunities, such as in underground compressed storage or underground hydrogen storage or geomechanical pumped storage, right? That these are opportunities to repurpose that expertise into an asset class that can also be very much a part of the solution for decarbonizing power systems. And I think that the key thing there is you have an entirely different expertise. Now you have to start understanding how gases and fluids are flowing in high pressure subterranean environments. And that's, as you noted, that is really a matter of a different engineering skill set than understanding electrochemistry or understanding thermal dynamics across media.
Hey, Jason, can you maybe address kind of the notion of the life? And I'm thinking particularly of like a lithium ion battery, life degradation, the number of cycles. That must be a consideration, I would say, probably with storage technologies. And are advancements being made there as well?
Yeah. So as you referenced, for the benefit of the audience, lithium ion and all batteries degrade over time. They degrade at faster or slower rates based on their duty cycle. That is to say, how frequently they're cycling and how deeply they're cycling over time. And so there's no hard rules to how they degrade, because it really depends how they're used, right? you know, you can always use a sort of rule of thumb of like 1% per year decline in power storage capability. This is, of course, very well understood based in part on having now an over a decade track record for a lot of these assets on the grid. And most folks who are developing battery energy storage for grid purposes are accounting for that in their project designs, right? So there's two strategies in general. One is you overbuild the project up front with an amount of spare additional capacity. So you might have a contract for delivering 100 megawatts, but maybe you build 120 megawatts. And then that way, as the degradation occurs, there's no challenge to you meeting your contractual obligations to be able to deliver that 100 megawatts. The other route is an augmentation strategy where at certain points over the contracted life of the asset, you add or swap batteries in to restore the needed capacity to be able to deliver. And that choice is really going to be driven by economics and the considerations that a project developer or the contract off-taker wants to have in terms of how they think about this. Part of that may be based around, for example, the availability of upfront incentives. If you are given an upfront incentive, that will probably steer you more towards an overbuild strategy than an augmentation down the line strategy. On the other hand, if you see cost declines continuing and expect them to be fairly aggressive, then an augmentation strategy may be ultimately more economic in the longer run.
Great. So Jason, to think about what's next for the industry, right? We've talked about all these technologies, talked about how we're seeing a large penetration of renewables as we think about the energy transition. What's your view of what the energy storage industry will look like 5, 10, 20 years from now?
Well, you know, we at ESA see a vision of 100 gigawatts of new energy storage by the end of this decade. And I think that that's driven, of course, by two overarching challenges, the challenge to decarbonize and the challenge to be resilient. Both of those challenges, energy storage is extremely well suited as a core part of the solution set, right? And I think that the last decade, energy storage really came of age, right? It was even just 6 years ago when I started at ESA. By the way, today is my sixth anniversary at ESA. But when I started 6 years ago, there were, you know, maybe 300 megawatts on the grid, and it was all 15 and 30 minute batteries providing frequency regulation. And that was it. And today we are well over 3.5 gigawatts on our way this year, probably to almost doubling that. And we're just past this inflection point right now. And so I'm not just saying this because I'm the head of the Energy Storage Association, but I really do think that the decade ahead is the storage decade, right? Where just like wind and solar over the last decade really took off, over this coming decade, storage is clearly taking off. And honestly, if you'd asked me 2 years ago, 100 gigawatts of new storage by 2030, I would have been like, yeah, that's pretty aspirational. I wouldn't say that's aspirational anymore. I would say, yeah, that's doable, actually. I think that we're still obviously looking to policymakers to really set the framework and signals for understanding, are we going to tackle the climate crisis at scale with the resources it demands? But even under business as usual scenarios, there's an enormous amount of storage that's going to be deployed over the next decade. Business as usual scenarios keep going up. And if business as usual gets us close to 100 gigawatts, then I'm pretty optimistic that we'll make it there by the end of this decade. The other last thing I'll note is that there are so many exciting innovations, not just in technologies, but in business models right now. I can 100% assure you that it is not at all clear that 10 years from now, the grid energy storage space will look, it will have the same business models and the same way of operating as it does today. We're going to see a lot of business models getting updated over the course of the next several years.
Great. Well, Jason, thanks for sharing that vision. And again, congratulations on your anniversary with the Energy Storage Association. I want to thank you for chatting with Brian and I today. I definitely learned a lot about energy storage that I didn't know about before.
Absolutely, Jeffrey and Brian, thanks so much for having me on the pod.
We're glad to have you. Again, folks, thank you very much for listening. If you have questions, please reach out to us at cutting.carbon@ge.com. For Cutting Carbon and Brian Gutnicht, I'm your host, Jeff Goldmeer. Have a great day. Thanks for listening. If you want more information about today's episode, check out the resources available in our show notes. I'm your host, Jeff Goldmeer, and this is Cutting Carbon.